This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 102.7 in Gauteng and Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Well, time for one of our concluding panels of the year. And as we always do at this time of year, we start gazing into our crystal balls, which comes with all kinds of caveats and warnings and caution to beware of anyone who claims to know the whole truth, particularly about the future. The Economist, for example, the world's most respected and august publication on the economy, failed to predict the 2008 financial crash. Yet, I think very few would dispute the value of the perspective that a bit of forecasting offers. In an ambiguous world, I think value isn't in knowing the truth, but in the depth and the richness of your perspective. And it's really one person who can offer this. And the wisest person in the room is generally the room. So what we've done is assembled a room full of wise men for you today, starting with Liston Meintjes, who's our independent analyst and doyen among capital allocators. Liston, great to have you on a panel rather than with a view from the market for a change.
Good evening to you, the listeners, and the other panelists.
On the line, we've got John Orford, fund manager at Old Mutual. John, thanks for joining us.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
And George Herman, director and chief investment officer of Citadel. George, thanks for rounding up the trio.
Pleasure. Good afternoon, Michael.
So let's kick this off. George, perhaps you can just broadly speaking give us a view of the year that we've had from an asset class perspective. And when we say asset classes, I think for the listener out there, we'll talk quite broadly about stocks, bonds, property and commodities, to use four very large buckets here. And I think for me personally on this side of the mic, if I have to talk about trade wars for another year or two like we have been this year, I might just quit. It's been the big theme. It's trumped all else. What were the big themes impacting asset classes for you this year?
Well, it was a surprising year in that the U.S. market responded so positively in an environment where growth was slowing down. Global growth all around has been slowing down, but equities performed spectacularly. So in terms of your asset classes, if we start globally, then the equity asset class outperformed everything else by a mile. But what was peculiar was that some of the more defensive asset classes like bonds and gold and certain of the defensive sectors also performed well. So that makes it peculiar. To bring it home is, once again, we've got some normality at least restored, in the sense that for the year to date at least, the all share index 8.5% up to the end of November, outperforming the bond index at 8.2, and those are both ahead of cash. So at least some normalcy has returned to that kind of relationship in terms of the pecking order. So I think in that sense, maybe a good year.
Liston, your comments, just to look in the rearview mirror before we look out at 2020?
Well, again, I think one of the things that we have seen is largely a momentum-based set of investors. They're following the ones that are going up and increasing that move. So you've seen particularly the United States. I mean, if you look at world markets, it has definitely been the NASDAQ that has been the no surprise. It is in the information technology area. A lot of the other markets, if you look at them, you know, they've had various home problems, if you want to call it that, and whether you mention Shanghai or whether you mention Hong Kong. But the ones that did surprise me were the CAC and the DAX in Europe. Suddenly, you know, they were hitting new highs when I couldn't see any news that would lead me to believe this was a good indication of 2020.
I think many people, as you sent in a note to me over the weekend, would struggle to name you one or two of the top companies on the DAC, on the DAX and the CAC. And here we are talking about them having a really stellar year. John, the standout features of the year from an asset class perspective, looking in that rearview mirror, obviously the benefit of hindsight makes this the easy part of tonight's conversation. How do you read it?
I think to highlight the, if we contrast to last year, when earnings actually performed reasonably well, but markets performed very badly on the back of the multiple that investors were prepared to pay for them coming down sharply as people worried about the growth they would see in this year. And then this year, what we've had is, you know, the Fed moving to easing policy, and that's really supported a re-rating in the multiple or the price-earnings ratio. So even though earnings has been poor this year, The markets have done very well, as the other guests have said. I suppose the other thing from an SA point of view is that for all the talk of a downgrade, our bond market has actually delivered quite a good return to investors year to date.
And our currency is also, as I was just chatting with Chris Holdsworth, held up remarkably well towards the latter part of this year. Right, George, as we embark on this exercise in forecasting, I'm reminded of what Jason Zweig famously decried as using the irrelevant to predict the unknowable. It's a very fraught task. So I'll ask you all to identify one or perhaps two or three scenarios under which you indicate why you make the statements that are deemed to be reasonably likely. So it's a bit of scenario planning. What's your base case? What's the high road and the low road sort of thing? Starting with politics and economics, because it really is the political economy that has been driving sentiment in the USA and Trumpism. What's your outlook for 2020, which is a very key election year in the US?
Well, at Citadel, we try to avoid to make specific predictions because you are bound to be wrong, as you quite correctly said. But the scenario planning is important. The main ingredient in the core scenario for us at this point in time is the value of the dollar. The dollar has been exceptionally strong and surprisingly so to many, despite consensus seeing the dollar weakening already. As long as the dollar remains strong, it'll be difficult for equity markets to really make a further headway from their current levels already. So the first scenario and the core scenario is one where the dollar remains kind of strong. We look at the markets today and suddenly it has a little bit of a blip and people start rethinking that scenario. But that's an important scenario because that keeps U.S. inflation intact. It keeps interest rates low and more of the same.
Liston?
Well, I say the same. Mainline, you have to say it's pretty well steady as she goes. And I think, you know, it's an election year, presidential election year in the States. I don't think anybody in any position of authority is likely to do anything to disrupt whatever might be happening from the President of the United States. He is the key unknowable unknown to me. Whether we get a trade deal which he reneges on, whether we get one at all, whether he gets impeached, I don't think that's likely, to be honest. You know, there's so much rests on what he does, but we've had him all year. And believe me, I was quite concerned about 2019, saying, you know, with that man at the helm and the trade wars and threats that he's giving, it can't be a good year for the United States. And boy, was I wrong.
Well, that is one that has confounded many. I don't think you're the only one there, Listen. I was certainly one who was worried about the impulsiveness out of the White House and the Oval Office. But that pattern, just to stay on this point for a while longer, do you see that pattern that is Trump's style and modus operandi of America first and protectionism and populism? Do you see that remaining firmly entrenched as well?
Oh, absolutely. And virtually all the things that he promised except a wall have come through. He said he would do away with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and it's due to be replaced with a new one. He wants to renegotiate the whole of NATO. He wants to pull out of the Paris Accord of climate. And these were all promises that he made. So he has to look good on them. So I think it's very unlikely that, you know, he will change that style of America first, certainly not in a year in which he's looking for re-election.
John, when you look at that, it means tariffs and the World Trade Organization, and that story that is driving me crazy is certainly said to be a feature of next year as well. My big question is on perhaps what we're going to see in monetary policy in the US. And I think George alluded to it, that with a strong dollar, you continue to see interest rates at all-time lows and low inflation. Do you see that as your core scenario? What are you seeing as your main scenario in the US?
Yeah, I think the main point for me in the US is that the economy is actually slowing, and that's probably going to continue. And some of the data that came out today, the ISM manufacturing PMI was reflecting another weak month. So that trend is probably in place, and on the back of that, the Fed has cut a bit. I think that how much more they do will depend very much on the economy. If it continues to soften and in fact weaken a bit, they'll have to cut a bit more. And I'm not sure that's good news for the equity market, because that would imply that the earnings recovery that's priced into U.S. equity markets is likely to disappoint. I think as far as Trump goes, I agree that the sort of populist stance that he's taken is unlikely to change. Although I do think on the trade side, he's got some incentive at least to appear to do a deal that's favorable for the U.S. Going into the elections. But I think, you know, that will remain an issue on the agenda for markets for the next few years. It's not something that's going away.
George, over the Atlantic, we've got almost a bifurcated Europe, with things happening in Britain hurtling towards a Brexit, and the polls having a Tory Bojo victory, setting up Brexit fairly swiftly into the new year. And then obviously Europe and what's happening there, the largest, wealthiest economy with high standards of living, very important that for luxury goods manufacturers as well. How do you see things playing out, firstly in Britain and then Europe at large?
Well, Britain, you have to make a call on Brexit, and that is the most impossible thing right now. So let's just agree that it's going to be messy, whichever way this is going to go. So very much like in the US-China trade war scenario, we go from the stance that the two largest economies in the world are at economic war with each other. In that same way, you can essentially say that the UK and the EU is kind of at economic war with each other, because it's going to be a messy end to that. The end result, however, is a very slow growth environment with a lot of uncertainty and risk. So yes, the risk premiums have been pushed out immensely. So the equities seem cheap and seem valuable, but you're going to have to look for the catalyst. And from the growth perspective, I still don't see the catalyst there and consider that a very dangerous territory.
It sounds, listen, like George is saying, a recession perhaps inevitable over in the UK. Chatting to Spar CEO Graham O'Connor at their most recent results, despite doing quite well in Ireland, they just sort of look at what's going on with Brexit and remind us that we can be quite thankful that we have Cyril Ramaphosa as our president, which is quite saying something.
Well, again, I come back to Brexit, and I'm saying, you know, it has been totally messy. It can't get any better, but at least we will have some degree of certainty. Then they have to sit down and they have to reword and rework all of the trade agreements. And that will keep lawyers and accountants busy for probably 7 or 8 years. I mean, we'll spin it out, of course. But the only one that really matters is the Irish border. You know, I want to see how they do that. And it's in everybody's interest largely to keep things as they are. It's just a question of how you word that in some legal documents. So that's you know, on the Brexit. On the other side, I've said, and when I was in the UK a couple of years back, all I could see were cranes building new multi-story buildings on the old London dockyards. And that's all stopping. Those workers have to go home or they have to find some other work. I suggest they are heading for a recession with or without a messy Brexit.
And in the rest of Europe, your note about the DAX and the CAC is an interesting one, but it's one of those markets where we've seen very little coherency. There is, despite this common interest in Brussels being, you know, reminding us that the European Union is strong, we still got Quitterly, we still got all of these so-called pigs nations with their own fiscal problems on the periphery. How do you see that playing out?
Well, bring it back to the CAC, and I actually like to make this point. And nobody knows the biggest stock in the CAC, but it happens to be LVMH. And it is considerably bigger than the next. And if you get to number four, that's L'Oreal. Now, these are world organizations, and especially geared to luxury. So the idea that, you know, the Chinese and Indian middle classes are growing, it hasn't been too bad for the CAC. How about that?
That's a great little stat. And we know LVMH recently took out Tiffany & Co. In a multi-billion rand transaction that has certainly got Johann Rupert's Richemont sitting up and taking notice, I believe. John, as you see things playing out in Britain and Europe, do you have anything to add to that? That does seem to be pretty much the consensus baseline scenario that Herman and Liston, I mean George and Liston, have just painted.
Yeah, I suppose the hopeful side is that the election in the UK will give us more certainty about whether Brexit can be achieved and in what sort of form. But then we've got to look forward to, you know, a long period of sort of sorting out the detail. And to be honest, a move which probably reduces long-term growth rate in the UK. So, you know, it's not a great outlook. But I think hopefully we'll get a bit more certainty, and that usually is a positive for markets after, you know, such a sort of completely unknowable situation.
Yeah, what we're looking for in South Africa as we bring this back home from the geopolitical front is hopefully a lot more certainty next year. George, as I was chatting to Chris Holdsworth about the strength of the rand relative to our emerging market peers, it does seem we've seen a shift in sentiment despite S&P recently downgrading its outlook and despite there not being a clear solution to Eskom's debt burdens just yet and all kinds of policy issues like expropriation without compensation not being dealt with. How do you see that playing out in South Africa over the next 12 months?
Well, there's many uncertainties, many of whom you've listed. I don't see how many of those get resolved. The pace at which we are getting certainty and resolution to these issues are exceptionally slow and super disappointing. The rand has had some benefit of a more accommodating stance by global central banks. But this is a little honeymoon that is that's going to come to a crashing end by our budget time in February, because Moody's is more than likely to wake up from their sleep around that time. And yes, it might have been priced into a certain extent, but as you know, you go into a boxing match, you take the first punch on the nose, your eyes start tearing up, and that's exactly what's going to happen to the rand.
That means enjoy it while it lasts. Maybe go and stock up on your offshore portfolio. Listen, how do you see all of these known unknowns and unknown unknowns playing out next year?
Well, I say the rand is by far the most important thing for any South African investor. You either take all the money offshore or you decide that something is going to happen well in South Africa, or you even go into our major indices, which have some pretty substantial exposure to international. And again, the biggest problem, and so I tend to go the scenario planning route here, and I say, okay, it may have a low probability, but what about the rand at 11.50, inflation at 2, interest rates at 4? What a wonderful scenario. The other opposite, and you can give a good case for it, I guess, is that the rand goes to 17 and or even higher than that. Just some bad news, but also the fact that we keep running a balance of payments deficit and it doesn't get well funded. We really don't have a way of dealing with that. But on that one, you know, you're having to look 100% at offshore items rather than local. It will be painful for everybody, and it probably means higher interest rates. Now, if those are the two alternatives, my goodness me, I'd flip a coin. I don't know which way you want to go. But obviously, there's what we call muddle through the middle, which we've largely been doing for quite some time. And that's where the rand stays in this 14 to 16 band. And, you know, the 16 happens on a blip, and the 14 happens on some really good news. And it has a reasonable chance of occurrence. Now, I believe that in that situation, again, it's a surprise, but many of the international companies and even the local companies with a lot of offshore exposure do well. The best you can hope for is at the lower end that the retailers do better because they can import at lower cost and pass that on to others. So that's why I say it's now putting probabilities on those. I don't even want to bring that into this discussion.
Oh, well, that's exactly what I wanted to bring into the discussion, John. What is your probability of those three scenarios that Liston has just painted for the South African rand and the economy at large?
I think that the one way of looking at it is we do these return expectations by an asset class, every update them every 6 months or so. And now as point forecasts, they're probably not that useful. But what we have been doing is from 2015, SA assets look pretty expensive, and we had, we expected poor returns from that period onwards. And we've had that by and large. You know, equity markets have gone sideways in South Africa, especially adjusting for inflation. They've gone backwards. And, you know, the return expectation now is actually considerably better for some of the local assets, the equity market, the bond market, et cetera. So we see better value in South African assets. Now, obviously, it depends a lot in terms of what happens next year, what happens to the global economy. But there you've got interest rates in Europe at negative. We've got a fifth of the world's government bond markets giving you negative yields. So there's got to be some value in South African bonds giving you a 5% real yield. So a lot of the risks associated with South Africa are priced in. And so while the scenario that Vincent painted of the Rand being considerably stronger may be a relatively low scenario, it is something you need to take account in your portfolio. So I think if we look at South Africa, the reform has been disappointingly slow, but it is happening. I mean, to take one example, if you look at the energy sector now, it's predominantly coal, it's predominantly owned by the government. But under the government's plan, they've got to implement it, of course, in 10 years, it will be 40% privately produced energy in South Africa. Now, that's a dramatic change in attitude from the government. And if we get a little bit of that coming through, I think things may look a bit better in South Africa.
Just a little bit of that coming through in the execution. We certainly hope to see a great deal more of it in the execution in the year ahead, because that's exactly what the South African economy needs to get out of this low growth trap. We're expecting to see anything from a slight decline in GDP tomorrow based on a poll of Reuters economists to only marginally growth of around 0.5%. So it just shows you just how moribund this economy has been and remains. In the bond market, and as we round off the conversation here, George, the bond markets have been very interesting, and the Fed funds rate is often regarded as the world's risk-free rate. Is it as risk-free as it's being made out to be, considering what's happening with the yield curve over in the US?
Yes, despite all the doomsday prophets around the future of the dollar, it still remains the safe haven asset. And yes, we never talk about entirely risk-free, because the price risk is also still in there. We're going to face some repo challenges in the end of December this year, which could bring in some volatility into those markets. But if you're worried about getting your capital back, yes, it is a risk-free rate in that sense. And so yes, US interest rates are still the best place as a safe haven asset.
Listen, bonds for you, where would you be allocating?
Now, again, I'm absolutely zero on anything that is close to zero. So I don't allocate there, because I just don't think you can get a reasonable return. If you come to South Africa, there is certainly a chance that we can see rates 100 basis points lower. I'm not saying when, I'm not saying how, but I would be very surprised if we don't get a downgrade and we don't then get a reduction in interest rates. So it's a little bit of if and but there is a potential reward there, and there's not much risk. So I'm a big reward for risk player. In America, to me, it's zero reward for lots of risk.
Benjamin Graham's margin of safety firmly springs to mind there. John, just lastly then, on the equity side, where do you see the major equity markets? Let's talk the US markets, our own markets, and Europe heading next year.
We are pretty cautious on the US outlook, largely because we think that the valuations are high and the earnings levels are high, and that margins will be under pressure as the economy slows and wages are still in an upward trend. That'll squeeze margins in the US. So there's better opportunities outside of the US, either in some of the European equities, emerging markets, and also in our own market. Obviously, we, sorely lacking a catalyst in domestic sort of earnings and growth trajectory, but a lot of shares have beaten down. There's a lot more value here, so we've positioned that way in our portfolios. We have a bit more in SA assets than we might have through the cycle, and we've got a bit less in the US.
Well, there we go. That's where we're going to have to leave it. And we haven't even spoken about the NZX 50, which is up 28.8% year to date. So there are some pockets of real growth in emerging markets still. John Orford, fund manager at Old Mutual, Lister Mainchies, independent analyst, and George Herman, director and chief investment officer. With your preview of the asset classes for 2020. That's a wrap from the team tonight. My thanks to sound engineers Mataba Taba Rodebe and producer Andries Mashlangu. Sylvia A is in the Jazz Lounge for you in Cape Town, and in Gauteng, Carolyn Stain up next with the smoothest classics on Winding Down. Good night.